It was very touching. And they put all 109 flags behind the original 50. It was a very impressive ceremony. But now up to 159 members. But the charter, I think, works on balance very well.
Now,
before exploring the next phases of your association with the United Nations, it might... it might be appropriate to ask you your impression of the attitudes of the major colonial powers toward the provisions relating to trust and non-self-governing territories in the Charter as a system developed in the UN. I'm thinking in particular of Britain, France, Belgium, and Portugal. Did they consider that the United States was pushing them too fast and too hard?
Yes.
I'm thinking of Churchill's remark that he did not become the King's first minister to preside over the liquidation of an empire.
Yes. No, they were very unhappy with our anti-colonial stand, and we pushed it pretty hard. Of course, we were a colonial power ourselves, but on a modest scale compared to them. And they were very unhappy with the way we pushed all this. And we've come a little later, I presume, to the London Preparatory Commission meeting. But there, the United States pushed through, Benjamin Gehring, Ralph Bunche, and I on the sidelines, pushed through a resolution requesting the states administering dependent territories to submit their first annual reports in time for the meeting of the General Assembly in September. This was January. And that was not very popular with the other colonial powers, but we wanted to focus attention on that issue. And one of my jobs was to collect the papers for the United States. We were the first ones to get them in and get our annual reports in. And that was one of my major gaffes in my State Department career. Under Alger Hiss's direction, I was told to get the latest governor report for Puerto Rico, Hawaii, Virgin Islands, whatnot. And I also collected one from the War Department on the Panama Canal. And I drafted a press release which made the front page of the Times, the United States' first administering power to submit its reports to the General Assembly, and the roof fell in on me because the Assistant Secretary for Latin American Affairs said the Panama Canal is not a dependent territory, it's just a canal. You must withdraw that report immediately. Well, Secretary Acheson had a major confrontation between Alger Hiss on my side and the Assistant Secretary, whose name escapes me at the moment, Spurl Braden, does that sound right?
Yes, Spurl Braden, yeah.
On the Latin American side. And Acheson reached one of those marvelous Solomon type of decisions that if Panama objected, we would withdraw the report. Braden insisted that we withdraw the Panama report. But only if Panama objected would we withdraw the report. But under no circumstances would we ever submit another one. Well, fortunately, Panama did not object, so the report stayed.
They didn't object. No, I thought they did.
No, I don't think so. At least as far as I can remember. But it was a very embarrassing moment for me. I just goofed. And I didn't consult enough people, and especially Mr. Braden.
Yes, and those inter-bureaucratic...
Oh.
I know what you mean.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, after San Francisco, I hope you had a well-deserved vacation before you took off for London.
Yes, I think so.
At that time, you were acting associate chief of the Division of Dependent Area Affairs.
Goodness.
What precisely were your duties in London in that autumn during the Preparatory Commission? Were you assigned to Committee 4, which dealt with the trusteeship matters?
Yes, as I remember, Gehring, Bunche, and I were all in that field and lobbying to get this resolution through, calling on the colonial powers to submit their reports in time for the regular session of the General Assembly. And we did a great deal of lobbying in this field. And one of my favorite Bunche stories is after just a day or two before the Preparatory Commission broke up, we decided that we would give a cocktail party for all the people who had helped us, the Western Europeans and a few of the Latin Americans, and especially the Scandinavians. The Danish delegate had been most active and most helpful. So Benjamin Gehring was to invite 5, and Bunche was to invite 5, and I would do something like that, delegates. And Bunche's list included the Scandinavians, the Danish delegate. Well, the party started off, and there was no Danish delegate. The Swedish delegate was there. So after the party was over, Gary and I corralled Bunch and said, for heaven's sakes, where was the Danish delegate? Why the Swede? Oh, said Ralph Bunch, you know, to us black folks, all Scandinavians look alike.
Oh, that sounds like Ralph Bunch. But, John, well, we've been talking a lot, Mr. Green, about Ben Gehrig.
Yes.
I remember meeting him on a number of occasions, both in London and later on. What was he like? What was his background? He was a specialist in dependent areas?
Yes. I cannot remember his background, I'm sorry to say. And he was a very difficult person to work with.
He was.
In fact, I changed jobs finally. I just couldn't take it any longer. He was very self-centered, very independent, wanted credit, take all the credit for himself, and I just couldn't take it any longer. And that's when I shifted jobs over to Walter Kochnig in economic and social affairs.
But he stayed on in the State Department.
Oh, I think so, yes.
I think so, yes. That's right. I recall he was there for a long, long time. Yeah. Now, I recall that this Committee 4 of the Preparatory Commission drew up the provisional rules of procedure for the Trusteeship Council, but it couldn't do much more because no trusteeship agreements had yet been drawn up. Now, there was a proposal, I believe, before the committee that a temporary trusteeship committee should be set up to carry out certain of the functions assigned to by the charter to the trusteeship council before the council could be established.
You've really done your homework.
But the Russians and the Yugoslavs, among others, said this is contrary to the charter. It was never done. You recall anything like that?
No, I'm sorry.
All right. Now, did you remain in London after the Preparatory Commission for the first session of the General Assembly, or did you go back to Washington for a time? There wasn't a great deal. I think there was only about 6 weeks in there.
I think so. No, I think I went back to Washington.
You did? Yep. Now, you're listed in the delegations of the Assembly as an advisor. Mm-hmm. That was particularly in trusteeship-dependent areas.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Next to the British, who, after all, were in their hometown, the Americans had the largest delegation of all.
Yes. As usual.
And there were as many categories, I guess, as there are prelates in the Vatican. I have seen delegates and alternates, special advisors, senior advisors, and just advisors. I see Alger Hiss was listed as a special advisor. What, for example, did he do then?
I really don't know. How strange.
I don't remember him particularly in London.
No.
But he was there, all right.
Yeah, I just don't remember. Sorry.
And I remember, of course, seeing Leo Pasvolsky there.
Yes.
What was he doing? Seeing whether his charter was working?
Probably running the show.
Now, there were a couple of new names that appeared on the delegation list for the first time.
Oh.
I'm thinking of Eleanor Roosevelt and Adlai Stevenson. Did you see either of them in action?
Not much. I'd forgotten that they were there. This is the Preparatory Commission.
No, this is the first session.
Oh, the first session. Oh, I beg
your pardon.
Oh, yes, the January session.
Adlai Stevenson was actually at the Preparatory Commission.
Yes,
but Mrs. Roosevelt didn't come over until the January.
Yeah, that's right. And those days you traveled by ship. We all came back, I think, on the same ship.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they used to say that the end of the General Assembly depended on the final sailing of the Queen Mary.
Yes, before Christmas, yes.
Yes, before Christmas.
Yep.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Bunch did not join the Secretariat until after London. I don't know when it was. Did you work closely with him in London at that time?
I really don't recall. Sorry. This is the London Assembly.
Yes.
Well, probably.
I remember seeing him in London.
Yeah.
And I believe he was working on trusteeship matters at the time.
Well, I think so, yes.
Because that's what he came to in the Secretariat.
It was always Gehrig, Bunch, and Green in that order.
Yes. Yes. If you had to describe Bunch now for future generations, and I'm thinking this is going to be used in the next 25 or 50 years, how would you describe the man?
Oh, an extraordinary combination of intelligence and warmth and humor. He had the great sense of humor. The only time he... These were the days of semi-segregation in Washington in those days. And blacks were not admitted to commercial restaurants. So when some of those white folks would be going out for lunch with Ralph Bunche, he would speak French, and we would introduce him as the ambassador of Haiti.
Really?
And got him in. And even in the government cafeterias, the whites were always out in the center part, and the blacks were around a corner, out of sight. And we always plunked Ralph right down in the middle of the central part of the cafeteria, especially over at the Pentagon. And the colonels were not amused.
Isn't that? Yeah, you can't believe it. That was only 40 years or so ago.
That's right. And the only time Ralph ever lost his temper on the segregation issue was when the family dog died. And the bunch of children wanted a proper burial out in the National Pet Cemetery, whatever it's called in Washington. So Ralph went out to make the arrangements, and he found, to his dismay, there was one section for the pets of white folks and another section for the pets of black folks. He said, that's too much. That's the only time he ever lost his temper over segregation. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And he never lost that fighting spirit right up until the end.
No. Once, I still remember the conversation, we were having lunch with him, and it had just been announced that Paul Robeson was going off to Moscow and Peking. And Ralph said something I have never forgotten, that you white folks, he always said, you white folks must understand that a black man who has a sense of humor, like me, Ralph, can survive anything. But a black man who does not have a sense of humor, like Paul Robeson, turns to wine, women, song, or communism. I've never forgotten that.
Well, I remember it was in the 60s, probably about 68. It was during the Vietnam War. We had one of the biggest demonstrations on a Saturday in April that I've ever seen in New York, and it was led by Martin Luther King.
Oh. Yes.
And it was announced that King was going to come to present a petition to the UN. Hmm. And there were literally hundreds of thousands of people out there on the streets. Mm-hmm. And the question was, who was going to accept the petition? Was it going to be U Thant? Mm-hmm. And everybody advised U Thant to stay home that day. And so it came down to Ralph Bunche. Mm-hmm. He was black, yep. He was American, and he was a Nobel Peace Prize winner. You couldn't touch him. Well, I, for some reason or other, was elected to go down to the gate to collect King. And when you collected King, you collected Benjamin Spock and, I don't know, about a half a dozen others, and take him up to the 38th floor. And King was very nervous. Mm-hmm. And I think Ralph Bunche was very nervous.
I think so.
But, you know, suddenly they shook hands, and Ralph Bunche had a marvelous sense of timing because he leaned over and he said, Martin, I haven't seen you since we were on that Freedom March together in Selma. And it broke the tension completely. And here were the one Nobel Peace Prize winner and a future one sitting there talking about the civil rights movement in America. And Ralph accepted the petition. Yeah. It went off beautifully, smoothly. But that's one of my favorite memories of Ralph Bunche.
Oh, that's very impressive, yes.
Yeah.
Goodness.
Yeah. Because he felt very, very strongly about the Vietnam War, as you know.
Yes.
And because despite his feelings, Ralph Jr., volunteered to go to Vietnam.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, that I'd forgotten.
Now, let's come back to the London session of the General Assembly, that first session there.
Yeah.
Again, the trusteeship agreements hadn't yet been negotiated. As I recall reading, certain of the countries that had League of Nations mandates, I'm thinking now of the UK and Belgium, for example, indicated that their governments were preparing draft trusteeship agreements, and that Australia and New Zealand said they were prepared to place their mandated territories under trusteeship. The two countries that, from my reading, appear to have been in the dock a bit during that session of the Assembly were France, which announced that it would continue to administer the mandated territories of Togoland and the Cameroons in the spirit of the mandate. And South Africa, which didn't make any offer at all about Southwest Africa and Namibia.
Yeah.
Do you recall those circumstances? Do you?
No, but that sounds correct.
Yeah. Was there much tension during that session of the General Assembly?
I don't think so. Of course, the South Africans have always been absolutely adamant on
Yes, I mean, they've never moved an inch on that. Now, in that first London session, did the committee concentrate, Committee 4, that is, on entirely on trusteeship matters, or did it devote at least a part of its time to the Declaration on Non-Self-Governing Territories and that Article 73E information?
I think the latter. I think they went beyond trusteeship into the general
they did.
Colonial area, but it's very shaky now. I'm very shaky.
And during the session, that session of the General Assembly, did you get to know or see in action the First Secretary General, Twigley Lee? Because he came in around the 1st of February. You know?
I think so. No, I have no memory of that.
You have no memory of him, don't you? Yeah. Right. Now, when we come up to the second part of the first session of the General Assembly, which was held a late success, beginning in October of 46. Did you come up to New York for all part of that session, or were you working from Washington? I say that because there are telephone records showing that you were consulted in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly was at late success part of the time, but I see you. It could have been the following year, because I well remember that the one advantage of meetings at Lake Success was you had a captive delegate for 45 minutes to brief on the way out.
Oh, I see.
Going.
In the car.
Yes.
In the hotel.
It was very dull coming back. The meeting was over and everybody was hungry and wanted to get home. But going out, it was a great advantage to have a captive delegate who had to listen.
Well, why I say this. Did the State Department prepare a lot of briefs in your division for, say, the London meetings?
I don't remember. Probably. But,
I didn't know how this was done. Yeah. Obviously, a lot of work had to be done for the Fourth Committee delegates.
I would think so, but I just don't remember. Doing it.
Well, there was one thing that was provided for in the Charter, which was a sort of time bomb, I believe, and that was in this Article 79 of the Charter, which says that the terms of trusteeship for each territory to be placed under the trusteeship system, including any alteration or amendment, shall be agreed upon by the states directly concerned. Mm-hmm. Now, there was not that phrase was never interpreted at that time. And it was during that London session of the General Assembly that the United States finally came down and said that it should be interpreted to mean only the state administering the trust territory, whereas the Soviet Union took a directly opposite view. Were you involved in all that?
No. But it sounds correct.
Yeah. In fact, after the trusteeship agreements were approved at the second session of the second part of the first session, the Russians tried to get them thrown out and didn't come to the first session of the trusteeship council.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you recall? This is a question that has intrigued me, and I haven't checked the record. Of course, eventually they came back.
Yes.
Do you recall the circumstances under which they did that?
No, but I remember people speculating that the Soviets realized they'd made a mistake of absenting themselves when decisions were
taken. The boycott. So Soviet boycotts just never worked.
No, and that they decided they made a mistake and swallowed their pride and came back. But, that was the speculation at the time. It didn't work.
Now, did you come to the first session of the Trusteeship Council? I know Sayre was the...
Francis Sayre.
He was the U.S. delegate.
Yes. Very able man, too.
Yeah.
Well, I thought I was at the first four sessions, but I may be wrong.
Now, there was about that time in, this would be 46, I see in one of the State Department records there's a note of telephone conversation which you had with a Mr. Middleton, First Secretary of the British Embassy.
Heavens.
And who wished to know the U.S. position on a British trusteeship agreement before communicating with London.
Hmm.
According to the record, you replied the U.S. did not oppose the provisions presented by the British, but you sought omission of the clause which stated, quote, subject to the approval of the General Assembly or the Trusteeship Council, unquote. What was this all about? You recall?
Heavens.
It's all in the records, Mr. Green.
That's rather frightening, isn't it?
Yes.
Did they actually record all the telephone calls?
It's all printed. Mm. State Department records.
Goodness. Awful.
And then late in November of 1946, there's a record of a meeting that you and Joe Johnson, among others, attended in Herschel Johnson's office, and this dealt with the question of a proposed trusteeship agreement for the Japanese mandated islands.
Hmm.
And there was, according to the record, there were three questions on the agenda. Under what authority is the United States proposing this trusteeship agreement? Is it possible to contend that the U.S. is the only state directly concerned? And what would be the position if Russia, for example, insists that it is a state directly concerned? Mm-hmm. Do you have any memory of the background of this discussion? Obviously, you must have been involved with those Japanese mandated territories
for
a long time.
And there was a major row in Washington about the future status of the Japanese mandated islands. State and Interior wanted to place them under an ordinary trusteeship. The War and Navy Departments, as they then were, wanted outright annexation. And there was a terrible row. And finally, it went to President Roosevelt just a few days before his death. And according to the reports at the time, one of the last decisions he took at Warm Springs was, let's try a strategic trusteeship agreement as a compromise. And, of course, that's what we did. And it was a very imaginative compromise.
Yes, it did.
Yeah. But it was a terrible row. It was just on the sidelines.
But tell me this. It was reported in the press at one point that the U.S. was considering turning over the Japanese mandate to the United Nations as the administering authority. Is there any truth in this, or did Washington ever seriously consider such a proposal?
I don't think so.
I mean, maybe just one of those press rumors.
Yes. No, I don't believe so.
Disappeared, yes. Well, now, immediately after the adoption of the trusteeship agreements, the assembly in New York in Flushing Meadow, proceeded to the constitution of the trusteeship council. Now, in addition to the eight members who were going to sit there, either as permanent members of the Security Council or administering members, there were two to be elected.
Yes.
And initially, we favored Iraq and Brazil. And according to the record, Ben Gehrig, who was with the delegation in New York, called you to report that Mexico was actively campaigning for a seat and becoming an important candidate, more important than Brazil. He claimed to have the backing of 16 Latin American and 6 Arab states. However, Senator Austin felt committed to Brazil. I believe you consulted with Mr. Dulles, among others, and reported back that there would be no objection to a switch in the U.S. support. Among the reasons you gave was that the Mexicans had been very helpful on Committee 4, whereas the Brazilians had done practically nothing. Do you recall any of this?
No.
I know. It's a very interesting point.
Yes.
Though, how we switch. And, of course, Brazil got elected.
Well, Brazil got elected.
Mexico.
Mexico.
Got elected. Yes. And I'm wondering how did this affect our relationship with Brazil if we suddenly switch? Yeah, I guess I'd have to ask a Latin American expert in the State Department. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating.
Well, you said that you continued your work for some time with dependent territories.
Yes.
And then you switched over to the economic and social side.
Yes.
And that would be in Committee 3, is that correct?
Yes, yes. I had 6 years in Committee 3.
But before we...
Deputy to Walter Kotsnik in the department.
Yes. Before we get on to that, I want to ask you one or two questions about, in the perspective of 40 years... Now, apart from the Trust Territory of the Pacific Islands, the Trusteeship Council has just about completed its agenda. What kind of a job has it done? Or let me be a little bit more precise. was a trusteeship period long enough to prepare these countries for independence? I'm thinking of a country like Tanzania, which seemingly has impossible economic and social problems. Or was the surge to independence inevitable? Was it a development whose time had come in the 1950s and 60s? How do you view it?
Oh, this? I think so, yes. The joke at San Francisco was the Trusteeship Council will be the first UN organ to work itself out of a job. And it's proved to be true. The only trustee left is the U.S. United Islands.
This leads me directly up to my next question, Mr. Green. I was going to say, did anybody, when the blueprints were drawn up at San Francisco, did anybody in the State Department or anywhere else ever pause to say, how are we going to get rid of the machinery once we put it in place?
No, I don't think they thought that far ahead.
No.
I don't remember the question. Ever
Have you got any ideas on that
no.
one?
But it's very interesting. There were originally, 13 mandated territories. Palestine, of course, was a separate case, became Israel. Southwest Africa is still a separate case. But the other 11 all graduated except the Japanese Mandate Islands, all gone into independence.
Yes. Yeah. And one of these months, unless the Soviets veto it in the Security Council, it's going to become independent.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So the council played its role. And I went out to Anaheim, California for the International Studies Association annual conference and presented a paper on the Trusteeship Council then and now. And it was very interesting. It took a lot of research work in the UN library, but I'll send you a copy if I can.
I'd like to read it very much, yeah. Because this is a question. Once the Trusteeship of the Pacific Islands is gone,
the council's out of a job.
I mean, some people will argue, perhaps, that we have to keep it in existence in case somebody else wants to put a trust territory under the UN, but that's I don't think it's going to happen. We'll have another, if something comes up like, what did we have? We had a temporary executive authority out there, the transition of West Irian from the Indonesian, from the Dutch to the Indonesian. Yeah. Yeah. But that was an ad hoc arrangement. That wasn't a trusteeship arrangement.
That's right. In that beautiful conference room at the UN.
Yeah. What should be the future for the Trusteeship Council? Got any ideas?
No. I haven't even thought about it. I should think it would just... I suppose it's in the charter. It has to be elected, but I don't have any work to do.
No. No. I guess they'll have to keep it in being the way they do in the Military Staff Committee.
Yeah. That must be the easiest job in the world.
Yeah. Now, I've noticed that in the 1950s, presumably, now tell me about the Third Committee. What were you actually doing there?
Well, I was the kind of senior advisor sitting right behind first Mrs. Roosevelt and then Mrs. Lord. And when special questions arose, like narcotics and so forth, the State Department would send up an expert. But I was just the general advisor and had to see the speeches were ready and the documents were in hand and so forth. But and then I would draft the remarks for the U.S. spokesman, or if Mrs. Roosevelt or Mrs. Lord were absent, I'd actually sit in the chair occasionally, which was very pleasant. But it was just general advice and keeping the delegate on the track.
Did you get involved much in the human rights discussions in the Third Committee?
Oh, yes. They were a very active part, as I remember. And, of course, Mrs. Roosevelt's prestige was such that, and as chairman of the Human Rights Commission, she could speak for herself on that one.
Because I know that you did a book in 1956 on the United Nations and human rights. Is that correct?
Oh, yes, yes. That part of the Brookings study.
The Brookings study, yes. Yeah. And I was going to say, did this grow out of your work in the Third Committee?
Yeah, I think so. As I remember. I did not go with Mrs. Roosevelt to the Human Rights Commission. She had two other State Department advisors in whom she trusted and liked. But then when Mrs. Lord took over, she immediately took me on as advisor for that, for the commission.
How would you say Mrs. Roosevelt was? Did she take advice easily, gracefully?
Oh, yes, yes. Very, very thoughtful person, and she would listen. She was extremely intelligent. She wrote so much and talked so much that she made gaffes all the time, as anybody would, and therefore people laughed at her. But she had a first-class mind behind all the rest of it. But she just did too much and did make mistakes.
And how about Mrs. Lord? Was she easy to work with?
Oh, yes. And she had a very difficult position, succeeding the most famous lady in the world. And, of course, Mrs. Roosevelt's whole policy on human rights